It's time now for the Sports Objective Podcast. No talking heads, just guys who love sports. Here's Dave Richmond.
Welcome into the Sports Objective Podcast. A very special evening here. As Bubba, we have a very special guest.
Absolutely. Very excited to have with us Dr. John Bream, a product of the ECU Brody School of Medicine. Dr. Bream, welcome in.
Thanks, John. Good to be back with you.
Absolutely. By the way, guys, right before we came on, I checked, and the Fountain of Wayne singer, lead singer, passed away today of complications from the coronavirus. Of course, their big hit, Stacy's Mom. So very sad.
Oh, wow. To hear.
Yep, that was just happening.
I'll tell you what, it's taking the toll on the music community. Now you got him, you got Joe Dippy. Do we lose Dr. Bream?
I think so, but...
No, you're good. I'm here. I can't hear you, Dave, for whatever reason. Sorry, I was just trying to text you instead of say it out loud.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Are you hearing Dave yet, John?
Yeah, I've got my volume all the way up. Can you guys hear me?
I can hear you.
No, for whatever reason, I can't hear a word Dave is saying, but...
I can hear you, John.
The audience can hear everybody. So, John, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you and Bubba just fine.
It's just okay, so you can hear Dave. All right, well, we're just going to have to relay. If Dave has a question directly for you, we'll just have to relay it.
All right, sounds good. Roll on.
But, yeah, what he was saying is the guy that was the lead singer of the band that sang Stacy's Mom passed away for complications for the coronavirus. So it's taking a toll on the music community with him, Joe Diffie. You have Jackson Brown, who has it.
Good news for Jackson, though. We did find out that I read today, it's just a mild case.
Yeah, Hanks and his wife, and Boris Johnson, and several other people. This virus is certainly not discriminating based on any sort of factors whatsoever. Other than kids seem to be doing well, but this virus certainly doesn't discriminate.
John, tell everybody before we get too deep into this, who may not be familiar with you and who you are, who you are.
So I am a practicing emergency medicine physician, board certified, residency trained at East Carolina's Vidit Medical Center, attended Brody School of Medicine and ECU for undergrad, and I'm currently the medical director at Novant Rowan Medical Center in Salisbury.
All right. Now, before we get too deep and we start taking questions from the viewers, just give everybody an update on how things are going in North Carolina. If they haven't heard the most recent numbers in terms of cases, those hospitalized, and the deceased.
Gotcha. So right now in North Carolina, per the Department of Health and Human Services website, we're at 1,584 cases. Looking at sort of some of the more live updates, those cases, it looks like we're at approximately a little over 1,700 now. The Department of Health and Human Services reports at least 10 deaths and 204 hospitalized. And then they're reporting that we're over 26,000 completed tests for the novel coronavirus.
And how do you think testing is going throughout the state? I mean, in terms of, I know that tests are having to be, I guess they're saving the tests for the sickest. Do you think we're getting any better in terms of the amount of tests out there for the general public? I know most hospitals and doctor's offices are still just using swabs and sending things to LabCorp and Quest. Do you think we're getting any better in terms, not just in North Carolina, I guess nationwide, in terms of testing?
Yeah, so I mean, I think things are getting better. I can tell you sort of anecdotally kind of what I'm seeing as a practicing physician, that our turnaround times are getting faster from LabCorp. I think hospitals have come up with sort of innovative ways to improve their testing. So I can give you an example for us. So what we came up with, because in general, LabCorp, we're using LabCorp. That's general knowledge. Most hospitals in North Carolina use a LabCorp. And so what we did was we came up with a priority process that allows certain tests to get expedited quicker. Somebody who is obviously admitted, if somebody's admitted and is certainly sicker, their test is, you know, certainly a little higher priority than, you know, somebody who's kind of walkie-talkie right. doing well. So we've come up with some processes to help kind of work around some of the delays and lag time. I think probably other hospitals are finding other innovative ways. There are some rapid tests that are being deployed in North Carolina. And I would say that I think our department will probably be getting those fairly soon.
And when and how is your hospital, and what are you hearing from other hospitals in the area, in the state, statewide? How are we doing on N95 masks and on ventilators?
As far as I've heard, as far as the state goes, I mean, everything right now is doing well. Obviously, this is mostly in its infancy here. You know, obviously, we're not at, you know, levels where we see in New York and some other states that are having a lot bigger issues with this right now. But as those IMHE models suggest, that it, you know, is coming to North Carolina soon. And so, you know, I can tell you that at our emergency department, you know, we've made significant upgrades, and the number of ventilators we're keeping in the ER. We've, you know, partitioned certain rooms off. So we basically have a room where we would put in your breathing tube, and then we would get you stabilized in that room and then move you to one or two other rooms. So we'll have the capacity to handle at least 5 intubated patients at one time in our emergency department. We've got all the supplies down there ready to roll for that extra. You know, you put in the breathing tube in this situation with a video camera. So basically you have used a little lighted video camera that pulls the tongue out of the way and exposes the vocal cords. And then it's kind of like, it really is kind of like playing a video game to maneuver the tube right into the vocal cords. And so then once we get them stabilized, you know, they would go somewhere where they could, you know, hold for, you know, ICU admission. So we've got all the supplies we need. I think we're very well prepared, certainly at my shop. I feel very good about where we are. You know, obviously, I don't know a lot about the other facilities, but I can confidently say, you know, being closer to all the Novant emergency medical directors, that I feel like Novant has done a good job of making sure we have the supplies we need and that we're all very well prepared.
And you feel confident in that as we, you know, you gear up and you believe what you're hearing in terms of the charts and when we're supposed to peak in the next couple of weeks going in towards the end of the month in May. I mean, is that when you think the peak's going to be? And do you say you feel confident, at least in your department, that you guys will be ready for the peak?
Yes, I mean, so I do think that the projections for North Carolina are accurate. You know, you can already tell that, you know, the lie tracker update says we're up to 15 deaths. Now, you know, that may or may not be 100% accurate, but it usually is. And so if that's accurate, then, you know, our number of deaths is doubled just today. So that's kind of what we're going to see. So I do think the projections are accurate. I do think sometime late April, early May is when we're going to see the peak of this. And hopefully North Carolina, if the projections are accurate, which again, I think they are, we can kind of be out of this by July, which is, you know, pretty much based on what China did, would be about right. It took them about 4 months to kind of get to recovery mode. So I think that can be what we would expect, being that we started seeing cases in North Carolina sort of in early March.
So you think by July, we will be what you call recovery mode? Do you think we will be still seeing cases, just dwindling down? Or do you think by July we'll be completely out of the woods for the time being?
Yeah, I think we'll be kind of where, you know, China is, where there's at least not any new cases. You know, the question will be, you know, in places where the outbreak is worse, kind of like New York, how long does that take? You do you restrict travel, you know, from people from New York, you know, or other places where there's still hot spots? A lot of that depends on how, you know, that approach occurs. So in China, there's still new cases, but the vast majority of them are people who are coming back into the country. So that's kind of what we got to be careful of, is that we, you know, do this correctly. If you look sort of back at past issues, like with SARS, for example, in Canada, you know, they had done well with it and eliminated it in Toronto, and then they relax the restrictions a little too early, and then there's a second peak. So you just have to be really careful how, you know, we reintroduce reintroduce normalcy into our lives.
Dr. Bream, we have a few questions from our listeners. The first is from Jacqueline. She says, do you think our shelter-in-place order will have a positive effect on our expected peak in North Carolina, or were we too late?
So I think it'll help. Unfortunately, I think we, and this is, again, any opinions I express are my personal opinions, and you don't represent the opinions of, any of my employers. But I do think we are probably a little late. We did the shelter in place order when we had, over 1,000 cases. So, but it's going to help. It absolutely will help. What we'll see, because this, virus can, be in your body for up to 2 weeks before you're showing symptoms. We will probably not see the effects of this for a few weeks. So that's going to be difficult to track. Certainly you won't see any impact today, but we'll have to see kind of what the impact of it is in 2 or 3 weeks to see if that curve, the big thing will be, will that curve start to flatten in 2 to 3 weeks? And if it does, then we'll know that our stay at home executive order has been effective. But I anticipate it will have positive effects.
Gotcha. Another question from Felicia. She says, what area in North Carolina is the most highly infected? Based on what I had seen earlier, probably about 25 to 27% of the cases were in Mecklenburg. You can correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Bream.
Great question. So this is actually one of the things I tackled in my daily update on my Facebook post tonight. So I broke North Carolina down by the three largest geographic area, or the three large metropolitan areas. So the Mecklenburg County metropolitan area. So I included Mecklenburg County, Gaston County, Union County, Cabarrus County, Iredell County, and Rowan County. And so they account for 616 out of the 1,584 cases reported by the Health and Human Services website. So I think that was 38% roughly. And then the Raleigh-Durham area, Wake County, Durham County, Johnston County, and Orange County had 375 cases, which if I remember was around 21% of the cases. And then Guilford County, Forsyth County, Davidson County, Alamance County, Randolph County, the Triad Metro had 146 cases, which was about 9.2% of the cases. So doing the quick math in my head, I can't remember. I think it came around to 71% of the cases were in the three largest metropolitan areas. And I was actually talking to a friend of mine who's really involved with ECU this morning. He's a great thinker about things, East Carolina University, Pat Lane. And I was actually emailing him back and forth this morning. And, I kind of have an airport theory on this, that you're seeing these cases, around areas with airports, because obviously this is where people are traveling in and out of. Business people are coming from out of town. And so obviously, they're the three largest cities, but it's also, where the airports are located. I mean, if you look, it's hard to say if it's an airport or it's just the metropolitan areas, but, the places that have, Detroit Wayne's a Delta hub, Atlanta's getting hammered, that's a Delta hub, Charlotte's getting hammered, that's an American hub, all the major airlines hub in New York City. So the areas where there seems to be hub cities for airports seem to be getting battered pretty hard.
Yeah, I got a follow up to that. Talking about areas affected in places in the metropolitan areas and in airports, community transfers of the disease. I saw a story earlier where there was two employees. I don't remember where the Lowe's was. It may have been in the Charlotte area, where two Lowe's hardware employees have tested positive. You look at that. That means they could have infected numerous people, numerous customers, et cetera. Hopefully not, but it's possible. So community transfer, and then at the prison in Greene County, a guard tested positive. And again, obviously those people are isolated, so if he infected them, they can't get out. But how are we doing, do you think, with community transfers in terms of people transferring it locally amongst family and friends and out in the general public versus, like you said, airports?
North Carolina is considered to have widespread community transmission at this point. I think at this point, I think what we're mostly seeing is cases that are transferred within the community. Anecdotally, I can tell you that's what I'm seeing. You know, people, like you said, people are going out, people are going to meetings and confined spaces, you know, those kinds of things are just, you know, are the ones who are coming down with it at this point. But, you know, when it was all said and done, reading the study out of China about this, you know, when it was all said and done, I think only 30% or so, it was like somewhere in the 30%, so I think it's 38% had some evidence of travel history that may have been involved. So, I mean, the vast majority of the cases are going to be end up being community transfer.
Dr. Bream, our next question is from Judd. He says he works as a first responder and his wife's an RN for a medical facility that deals with more outpatient type of services. At what point does an essential worker say, I'll move out or stay in a different location than my home to prevent the spread within their immediate family without having any symptoms?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that really depends on your personal preference. I can tell you I've made some definite lifestyle modifications, you know, that, my wife and I, you know, we're still, you know, of course, I've been working so much. My wife and I have pretty much been socially distanced from each other anyway, you know, with basically night shifts and, you know, basically meetings and stuff. I've basically stayed socially distant from her more or less. But, you know, when I come through the garage, you know, we put a separate hamper out there and I have changes of clothes out there. So I go in there, you know, put my scrubs in the hamper, take a shower, and then, you know, I leave my work shoes out there at all times. They never come in the house. I make sure that before I leave work, you know, I clean everything. My stethoscope gets cleaned before I put it in my car. My cell phone gets cleaned. My keys, you know, anything that's going to come in the house, it gets sterilized before I leave work. There are lots of people in the medical community who are doing those, you know, sleeping in separate rooms, all those sort of things. I think that kind of comes down to, you know, personal preference. You know, a lot of that is also, you know, would depend on, you know, if you have family members who say you lived, you know, with a family member who had, you know, some sort of immunocompromised condition or, you know, something like that, that would certainly impact those decisions. You know, my wife, you know, is pregnant, you know, but we do, you know, like even if we're just sitting on the couch, I mean, you know, we make sure to socially distance on the couch, you know, so we've definitely made some modifications, but, you know, like you said, it's best to kind of, if you're just hanging out, you just stay 6 feet from each other and all that good stuff, but it ultimately becomes a personal decision. But, you know, if there are lots of healthcare professionals who are doing that. If you're doing, I would certainly say it's not wrong. But you know, it ultimately comes a personal preference.
Dr. Bream, our next question is from James. He says, what are the typical first symptoms that one experiences and how does one distinguish COVID-19 from the cold, flu, or allergies?
Great. Another great question. So the first symptoms people are generally experiencing is a sore throat, fever, and cough. And so those are generally happening somewhere around, you know, kind of 2 to 3 days in. But in the, you know, generally just some fatigue, myalgias. And one of the things that's really starting to increase that people are talking about, and you've probably seen some reports about this out in the mainstream media, is that people are talking about your loss of taste and your loss of smell. So that's definitely one thing that you don't see with the flu. The symptoms for this generally seem to be a little bit more gradual, just kind of like, I don't feel well for a day or two. And then you'll get, you know, generally a sore throat, fever, and some cough. And then, you know, generally and most people stay at that stage. I do want to talk about this just for a minute, that most people stay at that stage where they have mild illness, and they don't, you know, progress any further. Like I said, at least, you know, 80-85% of people just have mild illness or no symptoms. They do well, they recover, and as far as we know, there are no sort of long-lasting issues. But then if people are going to start getting sicker, it usually seems to be around day 6 or so that people start to get, you know, where they're feeling short of breath and those kinds of things.
Do we have any idea about the underlying conditions why some people that are seemingly healthy and, you know, not that old are having problems with this in isolated cases?
Yeah, it's no one's really sure. You know, it's just, I think with any illness and any virus, you know, you see perfectly young, you know, even with the flu, I mean, there are some perfectly young, healthy people who end up dying from it. It's just, you know, sometimes your body's immune response just doesn't, you know, take care of the illness. So it's really hard to say for exactly, but we do know from the studies that there are several, you know, hypertension, cardiac disease in particular, really seems to be the one that is the biggest risk factor. But hypertension, diabetes, you know, COPD, all those underlying illnesses really seem to, you know, increase your risk of, you know, significant illness.
Our next question, Jessica. Jessica says, for the 80% of infected people who don't have complications, how long does the disease take to get over from the first day of symptoms to either the last day of symptoms or a negative test? Mm-hmm. Second question, are positive cases receiving a second test to confirm they are well after symptoms go away?
So the first question, generally about a week. That's kind of what the state has recommended, and you know, most guidelines say that. What I advise patients is that, you know, they need to self-quarantine, obviously, especially, you know, if we call them, but they need self-quarantine regardless if they have symptoms. And we're calling them with, you know, positive and negative results. I think one important thing to know is that, you know, there are, you know, false negatives out there that you can have, you know, false negative tests. The data I've seen is that, you know, the sensitivity to tests is somewhere between 70% and 80%. You know, I think it's, you know, getting better. So, you know, one out of every five cases or so, it could be, you know, a false negative where you could have symptoms and test negative. But you certainly need to self-quarantine. And what I tell people is that they need to self-quarantine for a week and until they've not had a fever for 3 days and until their respiratory symptoms are improving. So a decrease in their cough and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I tell them those, it's not an or thing. You have to have all three of those things. It has to have a week. Yes, has to have been a week, and you couldn't have had a fever for 3 days without any medicines, and your cough and your other respiratory symptoms have decreased.
What was the second part of that question, Bubba?
And the second part was about how are we? I think it was about how do we know when you're negative? Is that correct?
Yeah. The second part of the question, are positive cases receiving a second test to confirm they are well after the symptoms go away?
That's a great question. I'll be honest with you. I'm not 100% aware of that answer. That's a question I would pose to the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services and would, you know, ask them to consider making that clearer is – you know, what exactly constitutes a recovery? Does it mean a negative test? Does it mean symptom resolution? My guess, and this is an educated guess, is that being that there's a testing lack in North Carolina, I highly doubt we're second testing people. That's just a really good guess. I would say it's symptom resolution.
And the CDC recommends two negative tests in a row after someone's positive, correct?
That is what they've been using as a, you know, discharge criteria in other countries. Yes.
Good. Next question is from Mark. Mark says, do you recommend wearing a mask? Is it really making a difference on either side?
So for healthcare workers, absolutely. Because I mean, we're just exposed to this at all times, when we're at work. And so actually, where I work, you know, we have a universal masking policy that if you're at work in a patient care area that you're, you know, wearing a mask at all times. This is a standard surgical mask, you know, not an N95 mask. And as far, you know, the CDC and other, as far as I'm aware, the CDC and other organizations are not recommending the general public to wear masks. I mean, unless I've missed something in the past day or two. Admittedly, I've worked like literally the past 5 out of 6 nights. So it's kind of been, you know, work, sleep, eat, meetings, you know, sleep. So I certainly could have missed something. I'm going to be freely honest there, but I haven't seen anything to suggest the general public should be wearing masks. Because in general, if you're in the general public and you're practicing social distancing, you know, you're not going to be in range of where an aerosolizing particle should, you know, come near you. If you're generally talking, you know, particles generally only go about, you know, a foot or so. That could be fairly low risk.
I'm a follow up to that. If you do have surgical masks, not N95s, but just regular surgical mask or mask, mm-hmm. maybe you wear it to mow the grass to protect yourself from pollen, and you feel more comfortable wearing them to Walmart will they provide any protection if you were to get in close contact with somebody?
They're better than nothing. You know, the studies on this show that, you know, they're better than nothing. I mean, a little bit better than nothing. But, you know, the study looking at sort of N95 and 2-ply masks and cloth masks, and, you know, it really suggested that, you know, cloth masks really just provide minimal benefit. But I would say it's probably better than nothing.
Essentially, a bandana would do the same thing.
Correct.
Next question from Steven. He says, can someone be a carrier of the virus and not have any symptoms?
Absolutely. And that's kind of, you know, one of the big worries with this is that a lot of people, you know, the numbers are all over the place on what percentage of people are asymptomatic with this. You'll read some as their low as 15%, some of their high as 50%. But yeah, they can definitely be asymptomatic and still spread the coronavirus. So that's really one of the biggest things, and why social distancing is such a big deal, is because you may not know that you're infected, and then you get close to somebody who, you know, is susceptible, and then they end up getting the infection even though you don't get sick. That's essentially the point of social distancing. Kind of one of the interesting things I've read in the medical literature is suggesting that, you know, multiple people, and sometimes some of the estimates of this are up to 50% of the asymptomatic people have findings of coronavirus on a CT of the chest. So that even though you're not having symptoms, you know, you're still seeing CT findings. So that's also, you know, worrisome. That's something that will have to be monitored in the long term.
Interesting.
A question I had, John, obviously last Friday, Governor Roy Cooper put the shelter in place order into effect. And so that means obviously people with the essential jobs, they can go to work. People that need to go to the doctor, people that are going to the grocery store, drugstores, those types of places, they can do those things. But one of the things you've heard a lot in the media, you're hearing people from different media outlets encourage folks to support their local businesses, whether it's restaurants or what have you. That's obviously the main thing, the restaurants and just places that are offering the takeout, the curbside service and delivery services. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that's something that people should be doing?
Well, that's a dicey question.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, you know, the advice is to stay, you know, at home as much as possible. Now, granted, I think if you are literally just you are getting in the car and you're going to, you know, get, you know, something to eat and, you know, it's a curbside delivery thing where, like, literally they just have it outside, you know, waiting for you, or, you know, you go to like a table and, you know, you prepay and you pick up your order. I mean, I think the risk of that is significantly low. So I mean, I think that's probably okay. I mean, you know, I'm not gonna, you know, I live a life on the go. You know, going to, you know, I live an hour away from where I work. So, you know, all the way home, I'm usually hungry. And so I'll stop at, you know, Chick-fil-A or something. I think it's okay, you know, to generally, you know, go through a drive-through to pick up something, you know, curbside delivery or, you know, something like that. I mean, I think the risk of transmission from something like that is very small. And if, you know, I think that obviously if the state of North Carolina had significant concerns that there's going to be spread or risk of that, then they would have, you know, closed those down too.
And along those lines, John, I was just going to Walmart and looking at cars at places like Lowe's, et cetera. I mean, you know, this is just my opinion. I mean, I don't know what you think, but I think people have got to work on that, and there are essential businesses, but I think we might need to redefine essential if we really want this shutdown to work. You got too many people in stores, and there are some places open. I just wonder why they're open.
Right, you know, I think that would be, you know, a fair concern, but that's certainly it's out of my league there, Kyle.
Next question is from Josh. And, John, this is something you touched on a little bit earlier, at least to some extent. But Josh would like to know when you foresee the crisis stage of the coronavirus ending.
I think the crisis stage will probably end somewhere, you know, in June, probably. You know, if the big peak happens, you know, sometime late April, early May, then, you know, we'll see, you know, the cases start to gradually decrease probably by the end of May and June and really level off by the beginning of July. Like I said, I do think those are accurate. I think one thing to think about, though, is while those numbers will start to trickle down, these people are staying in the hospital for a really, really long time. You know, so the number of cases going down will not significantly alleviate the bed crunch in hospitals for quite some time. Like, the, you know, generally when people go in a hospital, you do come in, heck, I mean, if you have a heart attack, I mean, you're in the hospital for like 36 hours now. But I mean, these people who are coming to the hospital, they're staying in for months at times. So even though the case numbers are going to peak and go down, you know, the bed curve is going to remain high for quite some time. It's going to take it a long, it's going to take it a significantly long time behind it to start going down. So even though you're going to see the number of cases start to get lower and the number of new cases, you know, the effect on hospitals is going to take significantly longer to diminish.
Let's talk about the sanitation process a little bit. Mark would like to know, would, quote, deep cleaning or professionally sanitizing a workplace, specifically a manufacturing environment, be satisfactory in order to reopen a business for production?
It should be. You know, a lot of these places, you know, have these, you know, industrial. So what was kind of what we use in the hospital. So we have these things called HEPA filters, and basically they work by some sort of, you know, electromagnetic conduction to filter the air, and they pull, you know, all these particles out. And depending on how large your room is, you know, you just figure out what size HEPA filter you need by, you know, how large your area space is. So, and they obviously make them from, you know, filters that filter a small room, the filters, you know, that, you know, can you clean, you know, larger areas and rid the air of the virus. So, yeah, I do think that there are certainly, you know, sanitation processes that can be followed to get people, you know, back to work, you know, safely. For, you know, we do that, you know, in the hospital, you know, obviously, you know, and this is, you know, general information that, you know, would happen in any hospital, so I feel comfortable sharing it, is that, you know, we have the rooms that we do the highest risk stuff in, so put in breathing tubes and those kinds of things. You know, we generally have those filters in the room the rooms under negative pressure, where, you know, basically those particles are being filtered out of the air, you know, every, you know, depending on the size of the HEPA filter, anywhere between every 15 minutes and every hour. So it's certainly very possible. And then, you know, we have, you know, we're sanitizing each of those rooms after, you know, each use, you know, with a, you know, terminal clean. So, you know, there are definitely processes in place that can, you know, get you back to work safely.
We have a question from James in Southern Mississippi. He would like to know, obviously we've never seen anything like this before, not even close, but is there anything you can compare it to?
Nothing that I can say I've seen in my career, in particular. So I was, you know, I graduated from medical school in 2009. So that's kind of, you know, when the H1N1 was going on, but before I was a resident, I believe. Yeah. So I think that was in the flu season of 2009. I was unfortunately just barely young enough to not really have remembered, you know, the swine flu, you know, epidemic. But, you know, that seems to be what, you know, most people are, you know, comparing this to. But, you know, I don't know if it's really an accurate comparison, because obviously the swine flu, you know, afflicted, you know, 60 million people. Although, you know, the number of people that died from, you know, swine flu is actually less than in a general flu season. So it proved to be highly infectious, but not as deadly as the general flu, thankfully. So I can't say in my personal career that I've seen anything likely like this to compare to. And I don't think, you know, other than H1N1, it's been, you know, a long time in America since we can say we've seen anything to compare that to as well.
Yeah, and actually, I had H1N1. My wife had H1N1, and my nephew had H1N1 when it was going around.
Yeah, and it's still out there. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, when we do, you know, respiratory panel, when we had been doing, you know, anecdotally some respiratory panels on patients, you know, kind of early on this, we were seeing people who were still testing positive for H1N1. I mean, it is still out there. It's a, you know, part of the seasonal influenza virus. It's always out there.
We have a question from Krista. Krista would like, or she asked, now that it's here, what does this mean going forward? And once the cases slow down, what will the summer next fall look like? Can we expect it to rise again?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the honest answer to that is nobody really knows. So all we can really do is kind of look to see, well, what happened with other novel coronaviruses like SARS, you know, the first SARS, and then what happened with MERS, you know, Middle East respiratory syndrome. And so from what I've read, the kind of the consensus on this is that the first SARS just kind of mutate into a lesser virus that wasn't, you know, nearly as deadly. That's certainly what I read. And then, you know, MERS still exists out in the Middle East as a kind of a common virus, or, you know, a seasonal, you know, virus. So, you know, I don't think anybody knows. If I were guessing, and this, again, this is just me giving you, I guess, I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, social distancing and whatnot, that we will stamp this out. But I would just say I wouldn't be surprised if this ends up becoming a seasonal virus. But again, nobody really knows that for sure yet.
Yeah, Dr. Fauci, I never say his name right. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
He thinks it's coming back in the fall.
Yeah, I if you had to, you know, pin me down to an answer, I would say, yeah, I think that. That would be what I would guess. I would say, I think it's probably more likely to come back in the fall. And I think that's most of the consensus. And that's where, you know, these vaccine trials are going to be really, really important. But, you know, that's still, you know, probably a year away or so.
Will we play football this fall, John?
Will we play football this fall? Yes.
I'm holding you to this answer.
I mean, I would anticipate so, but I think it'll be on a altered schedule. You know, I don't know. I mean, this is, again, we'll stall football here for a second. You know, it seems like maybe we could push, you know, there's no reason that you've got, you know, week zero has to, you know, week zero could be the second week in September. You know, I mean, all you're competing with is, you know, NFL football, and that's on a completely different day. So I think as long as, you know, and the bowl games don't, you know, bowl games go into January. So, you know, eliminate some of these early bowl games, you know, extend the season, and you get it done. Or compress bowl season, you know, have, you know, three games in a day every day instead of having, like, oh, the Camellia Bowl and ESPN2. You know what I mean? Like, you know, just have more bowl games compressed. You know, have them back to back on, you know, several different networks. But yeah, I think they can. I think they'll find a way to get it done. I mean, I think, being frankly honest, you know, with NCAA, there's too much money at risk for them to not have college football season. If, you know, if the curve is leveling off, they'll find a way to get it done.
And then, not to get on the sports discussion, even though we are a sports agenda podcast, but you take schools like East Carolina and other groups of fives. I mean, I don't know what would happen if we didn't play football this fall. I don't know that budget wise, we might not have an athletic department.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a concern. Yeah, I posted an article, I think it's in Triangle Business Journal, that talked about sort of the effects that, it's going to have on college campuses, in the trying, you know, the, you know, in UNC, Duke, you know, NC State, all those schools. And, you know, it's not, you know, in this, you know, be more of a discussion of kind of what the coronavirus is doing to the economy in general, but, you know, you're now having to fund athletics fees, dorm fees, campus recreation fees, you know, all these things, you know, are getting refunded. And so this is major loss of revenue, not just for the athletics departments at these universities, but, you know, to the, you know, to just the, you know, general revenue of the university from what, you know, from tuition and all those kinds of, you know, or not tuition because they're still online classes, but, you know, from other sources of revenue for a university. So, I mean, if you're really not in a strong revenue position, you know, the university ultimately, and a lot of it functions as a business, you know, you've got to, you know, while the taxpayers do subsidize it to a degree, you know, you can't run at a major loss. You know, but so it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. I think, you know, I read some estimates like, you know, $300 million loss universities. It's just going to be, you know, massive, massive losses. And we'll have to see, you know, kind of, you know, what ends up happening there. But, you know, it's ECU specifically, you know, we all know here that, you know, ECU wasn't in the best financial position to start. And I think it's time to start making some hard decisions. I mean, it's probably time to cut some sports. I mean, if you want my opinion, you know, it's
Dave's not here right now, John.
All right. Yeah, it's probably time to cut a few sports. You know, we're going to have to do what we can, you know, to survive. And I know cutting sports is an unpopular.
Now, nobody wants to see it.
If nobody wants to do it, but, you know, it kind of gives you an excuse to do it. You know, we field, we field more sports than everybody but UConn in conference.
Yeah, UConn, now that UConn's in conference, we field the most. Yep.
Right. Yeah. So we'll field the most with the second smallest. Well, I guess, you know, what, Tulsa and Wichita State have smaller budgets. So, you know, with the third smallest budget, we field the most sports. It just doesn't make sense. So, I mean, that's where I'll leave it there.
John, we have some other questions.
Sure.
Mark would like to know, how would you rate where our confidence should measure in regards to the data and validity of the stats we've received from China thus far? And do you think even their own people know the real numbers?
So that's a tough question. So I'll kind of answer it in two parts. I think everybody knows that China was not forthcoming when this first started. I think there's probably universal agreement in that. So I would say, as far as the general numbers, I would maybe have moderate, if I was reading a low, moderate, or high, kind of moderate confidence. You know, you read some of these things about 20 million people, cell phones plans are now, you know, 20 million people's data is gone. The number of urns far exceeds what they're reporting the death toll to be.
I mean, they reported 3 million deaths, John. I mean, there's no way.
Right. So, I mean, I think it's probably, you know, I think now, do I think that they're giving us right numbers now about, you know, new transmission and cases like that? Yes. So that's kind of why I'd say moderate. That, you know, I think that it probably wasn't very accurate to start, but I do think it is probably better now. Now, I do have, you know, confidence in their scientific numbers. You know, when I'm looking at reading studies and stuff like that, you know, this is new in the Western world, you know, but in the Far East, you know, now they've had months to look at this. And so, you know, the stuff that we're, you know, basing our treatments on and everything like that, you know, all came from there. So I do have, you know, pretty good confidence in their scientists that, you know, they're not, you know, publishing things that aren't factual and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I think, so overall, you know, are the general numbers accurate? Probably not, but I have, you know, better confidence that the recent stuff that's coming out is better. And I have, you know, high confidence in the studies. And obviously, you know, JAMA and Lancet and all these other, you know, highly regarded journals would not be publishing their studies if they thought they weren't very good or weren't trustworthy.
John, a question pertaining to the schools. Obviously, every school system around the state's handled it a little bit differently in terms of whether they're taking the lunches to the kids or whether they're having the parents come and pick it up at the school. Here in Rowan Salisbury schools, both options are being offered. And they can go to the school for a 2-hour window, or the lunch is being taken to them, or actually breakfast and lunch. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the, you know, unfortunate reality of that situation is that, you know, if this wasn't happening, you know, we'd have, you know, kids that are going hungry. So, you know, it's just kind of to me, I think this is more of a humanitarian issue. It's just sort of, you know, by any means necessary. But I did read, you know, the great article, you know, at Rowan Salisbury schools with the buses delivering the meals and all that stuff. You know, I think they're doing good work there. But, you know, it's just, you know, it's definitely a humanitarian need in North Carolina, because, you know, if this wasn't happening, a lot of kids would be hungry. So I'm proud that even though the students aren't in schools, that the school systems have stepped up and really have, you know, helped make sure that students are still getting to eat.
Yeah, and then let's give a shout out to one of the volunteer bus drivers that's taking these meals to the kids, and he doesn't have to do it because he's a teacher, and he's doing it because he wants to. Right. Our own Bob Rosenbaum.
Right. And so, and we're seeing, I think this is, you know, a great time to highlight that even with, you know, the coronavirus pandemic and how it's, you know, affecting people's lives in a many different ways. You know, a lot of people are losing their jobs, and a lot of, you know, the spirit of volunteerism, you know, is seen, you know, a lot of people are, you know, people are making cloth masks for hospitals, you know, American Ingenuity is on display. You know, people are creating all kinds of new things to help us as healthcare workers stay safe. Big props to all the people who have, you know, really risen to the occasion to do great things in their communities in difficult situations.
And then while Bubba's out volunteering, you know, taking lunch to children, and you're saving lives there at the hospital, I'm doing my part by staying my ass at home.
Great job, Kyle.
Dr. Bream, a question. Obviously, one of those essential reasons that folks are allowed to leave home for is to go to the grocery store to get things they need. If going to the store, do you think it's necessary for an individual to spray their groceries with Lysol or wipe them down with disinfecting wipes before bringing them into their home?
And my sister asked that question, Bubba.
No.
Oh, Stacy asked it. Your wife. Okay. All
right. So are you talking about like certainly wipe your buggy down and stuff like 110%.
Yes.
Are you talking about like wipe your groceries down before you bring them inside?
Right. The actual groceries.
The packages.
I mean, I think it would probably be the safest thing to do. You know, whether it's overkill or not, I mean, who knows? But, you know, it's not going to hurt anything, that's for sure. You know, wiping it down with a, you know, alcohol-based wipe or something like that. Yeah, I mean it would definitely decontaminate your groceries. But, I mean, I guess that is a reasonable thought that somebody could, you know, cough on their hand and then grab the bottle of, you know, the milk jug and then put it back down or something. So, yeah, I mean, it's not going to hurt anything.
Would just spraying them with Lysol spray work? Aerosol Lysol spray?
Well, I mean, you probably need to, you know, that would probably miss a lot of the jug, but, you know, I probably would, you know, spray it and wipe it down real good.
Okay.
Let's see.
Your wife, Stacy right now is just, I can see her in the background making a face to Bubba.
Yeah, I started to say, Stacy, get your finger out of my face.
But you know, I mean, it might be overkill, but it's definitely not going to be harmful.
Yeah, definitely better safe than sorry, and that's definitely her policy. But
right, exactly.
Another question she has, she said, I've heard that vapor particles from the virus can live in the air for quite some time. To me, the distancing measures we've been applying wouldn't fully protect us. Is it true the particles can live in the air for a period of time longer than a few seconds?
So I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not 100% sure of the answer to that question, because this is stuff that started coming out last night. I'm aware that there was a researcher from MIT that has said this. Now I have, but I'll be honest with you, between working overnight and sleeping today and everything, I've had, you know, three conference calls this afternoon. I haven't got a chance to look at that data yet. I apologize.
This question is from Jessica Barber. Can you have the virus without a fever? And should we just avoid taking ibuprofen even if we don't have the virus?
Yes. So you can definitely have the virus without a fever. You know, that is, you know, we're seeing that, especially some of the articles talking about in pediatrics that, you know, up to 60% of the kids don't have a fever. So you can definitely have the virus without a fever. You can have, you know, low grade fever. You know, I can tell you, you know, in reviewing case presentations that, you know, they've kind of been all over the place. I mean, I would say that the majority of adults have a fever. Certainly, you know, the sickest people have a fever. But you certainly can have the virus without having a fever. You know, cough, you know, sore throat, they're kind of the predominant symptoms of fever. Definitely happens. It's just, you know, usually a little bit later, not much later, like within 24 hours. Like I said, but it's very common. You know, over 80% of people have a fever with it. Like I said, in kids, it's definitely not as common. And then what was Mrs. Barber's second question?
Ibuprofen.
That's right, ibuprofen. So, I mean, this is kind of how I look at this. I mean, it has been all over the map on this. You know, some say yes, some say no. You know, there's no definitive literature out there that suggests that you can't take ibuprofen with this. And in theory, so sort of the nerd discussion of this is that this virus enters the cell by binding to ACE receptors, which are, you know, expressed in the, you know, kidney, the lung, the heart, you know. And so basically, in theory, ibuprofen would increase the expression of those receptors so that it could potentially cause the virus to be more powerful, for, you know, lack of a better explanation. And so It's all theory. None of the leading health organizations I'm aware of. And again, I've been working a bunch the past few nights, but I would think that would be a mainstream media article.
Correct.
Are recommending to stop. So this is what my general approach to this has been. I would try Tylenol first, for sure. Like if you have aches and pains, you know, like, you know, you've been working out in the yard and your neck hurts or your back hurts or something like that. Yeah, I would try other intervention, you know, Tylenol, heat, you know, other, you know, Tylenol non-pharmaceutical interventions first, stretching and all that stuff. And if that doesn't help, then by all means, take a Motrin.
Yeah, I talk about medicine. Forgive me, I'm terrible with you. You'll know the medicines I'm talking about, the malaria medicine.
Yeah.
I read an article today about a lady in New York who was doing terrible. They started her on the malaria medicine and with another medicine. It was a combination of two medicines.
Yeah, Plaquenil and hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah, the next day her fever went down and she was discharged 7 days later.
So I've reviewed sort of all the studies on this and I've posted them all on my Facebook page. Not to be like shamelessly self-promoting or anything, because I'm not, but, you know, basically, I mean, I've been posting factual updates pretty much every day. And so this is a hot topic, you know, the Plaquenil, azithromycin, hydroxychloroquine combos. And so, you know, there's small, so I think there's an important thing to note here. They're all small studies. And so I think they're kind of just suggestive, but not definitive. So the first study was out of China. It was very small, 30 patients randomized, you know, 15 to each part of the study. And, you know, with, you know, hydroxychloroquine and no medicine, and there's no difference. It's really two studies. You know, the second study is like a continuation. So the writers out of France enrolled 42 people in a study, 26 people in the treatment arm, and then 16 people in the control group that didn't get hydroxychloroquine or hydroxychloroquine and Zithromax. And so basically what they did was they said, well, the 20 people who got hydroxychloroquine or hydroxychloroquine and Zithromax had viral clearance much faster than their counterparts. Than the control part. But so you have to read the study. This is where studies, you have to be really careful about reading them. And why peer review and refereeing them is very important before they get taken to the mainstream, is because what they don't tell you, and that what they would tell you is authors' conclusions, is that 20 people in the treatment arm had much faster viral clearance than the 16 people in the control arm. So that sounds great, right? Sounds like it works. What they don't tell you is that in the treatment arm, they excluded 6 people, 1 who died, 3 who were transferred to the ICU and all that stuff. So basically what they did is said of the well people who got hydroxychloroquine, you know, Plaquenil, Zithromax, some combination of those medicines, the viral clearance was faster. You know, that also doesn't tell us anything about their outcomes comparatively. You know, it sounds like they all did well, you know, both groups, but the viral clearance was faster. So that obviously brings up questions about, you know, what's important, the clinical outcome or viral clearance. So what they did, so if, you know, if you have one bad study, you know, what these guys did was like, okay, we'll make a bigger bad study. And so they took 80 people and they basically randomized them into groups based on upper respiratory and lower respiratory symptoms. And then they classified them by their new score, which is basically a severity score that grades your risk of deterioration and low risk, medium risk, and high risk. And so of the 80 people they enrolled, 92% of these people were in the low risk category. So basically, like, these are the people who should be doing well anyway. Like, basically, with no medicines, the data would say that, you know, these people should be doing well anyway. And so they gave them all the medicine. So they didn't do a control study. They didn't randomize against people who didn't get the medicine. So basically, if you break down the math of the study, 63 of the patients total to get better on their own without any medicine. And then what that study showed, that was 65% of the people who got medicine got better. So basically, there's probably not really any statistical significance of people who got better with the medicine who would have been expected to get better regardless. And even with the medicine, you know, if 15 people got admitted to the hospital, a few got into the ICU, one died. So what I would say about it is, so I'll give you a personal perspective. If I was sick with coronavirus and was sick enough to be admitted to the hospital, you know, I would want the medicine. But I don't know that I would have high confidence that the medicine would work. So kind of what I think about. So basically, if you're in a fight and one guy has a bazooka and then you've got a pocket knife, you're going to fight with your pocket knife, you know? So, you at least want to give yourself what chance is there. But, so while I think these studies have been, widely media circulated and painted in a more positive light than they are, it's kind of what we've got for now. So it's kind of, you know, where Dr. Fauci, you know, with the Trump administration has, you know, we've issued this emergency FDA clearance, but, you know, we don't really have, there's no real scientific data to suggest these medicines are going to be super helpful. And I would say they're certainly not looking like they're going to be magic bullets.
You mentioned if you were a patient, you were sick enough to be hospitalized, you would want the medicine. Is it available upon request? If a patient says, "Doc, I want that, give it to me, I'm hospitalized," or do they have to get some kind of special clearance, or how does that work? Could you guys?
So most of these medicines are under, I think this is stuff I can share generally, is that, you know, if you're admitted to the hospital, you know, it would be an infectious disease restricted drug, meaning that it would be something that the ID docs would have to order. I can speak, you know, to where I work, obviously, that we do have that medicine. You know, we have hydroxychloroquine and Plaquenil available for admitted patients. So, and I would think that most hospitals, you know, generally would at this point.
Okay.
Another question we had from Steven, he says, could the coronavirus be worse on a patient who had WPW, even though it was corrected with an ablation?
That is a great question. And I would say that the educated guess answer is, you know, because obviously this is not going to have been studied in a bunch of people at WPW, is probably not. You know, underlying, you know, heart damage, you know, so basically you've had a, you know, heart attack and you've got, you know, cardiac scarring and all that stuff. Yes. But I would say that, you know, WPW, you know, is likely not going to be a significant increased risk. That's, you know, more of a conduction abnormality and not a, you know, underlying heart disease, congestive heart failure sort of thing.
And what about, and I'm assuming that was Stephen Casper that asked that. And what about someone, you know, like me, just being a big guy, I have a rapid heart rate. I take the medicine and propanolol to slow it down. You know, I guess personally, I feel like with that in my history of having asthma and bronchitis when I was younger, I feel like I'm elevated risk just because of those things.
And you would be, you know, those are things, you know, obesity, you know, underlying lung conditions, you know, those are people who are higher risk. So continue to stay your tail at home, Kyle.
Okay. I'm going to say, I'm sure you said this video, Bubba. Okay. Yeah, you know, I do have a note from the doctor, but just in case.
Kyle, do you have any other questions for Dr. Bream?
No, not at this time. Is any more from the chat?
No, that's all the questions that we've had submitted thus far. One of the things I did want to kind of going away from the coronavirus, one of the things I did want to mention as we're preparing to get off the air tonight is just obviously SupDog's popular establishment in downtown Greenville, or excuse me, uptown Greenville. But SupDog's is battling Barstool KU at the University of Kansas and is trying to win another national championship as far as Barstool Best Bar. But if you have not already voted, go on Twitter and do so. Hashtag Barstool Best Bar, hashtag Barstool SupDogs. So you can do that until Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah, speaking of 7 p.m., Saturday night, 7 o'clock, be here. You ain't got nothing else to do. You can't go anywhere. We're going to have pirate and sports trivia with myself, Bubba, and Dave. Everybody join us. We're going to be giving away Domino's gift cards, I believe, to the winner. We're going to have to get, we don't know if it is, I'm not sure, is it the winner that gets it or Final Four, Bubba? Have we decided? But somebody's getting a Domino's gift card, and you can't win if you don't play. So be here 7 o'clock Saturday night for Pirate and Sports Trivia here on the Sports Objective Facebook page. And I did have one more question for Dr. Bream. Dr.
John is perfectly fine, by the way.
John, in your professional opinion, which do you think is more damaging, the coronavirus to the United States of America or Jeff Comfort, East Carolina?
Whoo, boy. well, I want to go with coronavirus because coronavirus is literally a matter of life and death. I want to take the easy way out on that one.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
But, John, on a serious note, a listener or viewer would like to know, as far as vitamin C, probiotics, what do you recommend, or like, what do you think the impact would be in that case?
So vitamin C has been pretty extensively studied in viral infections, you know, mostly the common cold, and basically all the studies kind of show, I mean, the vast majority are negative or show no benefit. There's a few studies that show maybe modest benefit, but again, I would put vitamin C in the "it ain't going to hurt you" category. You know, I wouldn't take it in obviously massive doses or whatnot, but you know, I have added a multivitamin to my daily regimen. You know, again, I'm a big believer, not just, you know, in coronavirus, but, you know, just in general as a physician, that if it's not going to hurt you, you know, it's, you know, it's okay. Like if you've got back pain or like ice or heat, I'm like, whichever one makes you feel better. Neither one are going to hurt you. You know, so, you know, just things like that. So, you know, multivitamins, you know, there's been a lot about, you know, somebody had talked about some things about zinc. You know, some American diets are zinc deficient, but that, you know, again, it'll be covered in multivitamin. You know, there's some theoretical protection from zinc, but I don't, you know, my suspicion is that, you know, in the human body, it's really not going to play a major role. But yeah, I mean, I would put it in the category of things I'm doing because they're not harmful, but probably aren't likely to make a major dent.
Yeah, and I got a question along those lines of not being harmful. Well, my wife had read a study earlier about something about, it sounds like nonsense to me, but something about drinking hot liquids constantly would help you from getting this, somehow keeping heat in your throat and digestive system. I don't know. It sounds like malarkey to me.
So I'll give you kind of what I guess the theory behind this is. So this virus is not very heat stable. So, you know, much like the flu, although this is more heat tolerant than the flu, you know, basically if you expose this virus to heat for like 15 minutes under 150 degrees, 150, then the virus will become pretty unstable after 15 minutes. So that's why, you know, the theory, you know, obviously with flu and with this, you know, we're hoping, you know, the hotter weather is going to help, but it has to be, you know, persistently elevated temperatures over 80 degrees are going to be helpful. They're not going to, you know, again, they're not the magic bullet. They're not the cure-all, but, you know, it will help. The other key to that is may not even be as much temperature as much as, you know, the increase in humidity. You know, winter air, colder, is drier. Droplets transmit easier. And so, you know, the North Carolina humidity, you know, particularly Eastern North Carolina humidity, you know, will help somewhat. But, you know,
drinking a bunch of hot coffee probably won't.
What's that?
Drinking a bunch of hot coffee probably isn't going to do anything.
Yeah, but generally drinking a little hot coffee as minimal amount of time as that's going to transiently increase the, you know, temperature in your throat is probably not going to help a whole lot.
John, we really appreciate your time. We appreciate you coming on and spending a little over an hour with us. I know our listeners, or viewers in this case, have really taken a lot from this conversation. We've had tremendous feedback, so thank you for everyone tuning in. And this will be archived not only on Facebook, we'll try to get it on our YouTube channel as well. You can find that by simply searching The Sports Objective, and it will be archived also everywhere you typically listen to our podcast, whether it's Google Play Music, SoundCloud, Audio Boom, Live Talk Radio, you name it, you can probably find us there.
Hey, Bubba.
Yep.
Can I include one more thing before we go?
Absolutely. Go right ahead.
I hope that, there's a lot of pirates, I'm sure, a lot of people, but in particular, this being, ECU, Sports Direct being particularly concerned with ECU, a lot of pirates out there who are listening. So I hope that everybody heard, the man, Ron Mitchelson's plea the other day to help, students from East Carolina who are displaced, East Carolina Student Emergency Fund. He posted about a minute and 45 second video really imploring, pirates to do what we do best, which, pirates help pirates. And for people to consider, making a donation to that fund. I've not donated yet. I will be donating soon. But for people to, make sure that they are, that pirates, do what we've always done, that, we take care of our own, and, pirates help pirates. So I just ask everybody out there in Pirate Nation to really listen to Ron. I mean, he's such a good guy. I think he'd be a great chancellor if he were interested. For us to consider, coming together, and those, if you're able, I'm sure if you only donate $5, $5 is better than $0. And so would really encourage people to consider making a donation to the ECU, Emergency Student Management Fund.
Absolutely. Interim Chancellor, like you mentioned, Dr. Ron Mitchelson, he's done a tremendous job. He's been at East Carolina in a couple different capacities, at least over the last 20 plus years. And so we certainly appreciate all he's done. And I would urge, just no matter what university you support, definitely do that with your school, whatever school that is. So, thanks so much again for your time, Dr. Bream, and we look forward to having you back on the show. Hopefully we'll talk sports more so than the coronavirus, but down the road, depending on how this progresses, we'll certainly have you back on. And to our listeners, definitely, like I said, you can find this on all of our platforms that you typically listen to our show. It will be archived tomorrow, tomorrow being Thursday, April the 2nd. And follow us on social media, on Twitter at TheSportsOBJ, on Instagram at TheSportsObjective, and like and follow us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You've been watching the Sports Objective Podcast with Dr. John Bream, a product of the East Carolina University Brody School of Medicine.
Thanks, guys. Go Pirates.
See y'all Saturday.
You've been listening to the Sports Objective Podcast. Join us next time as the guys will be objective, and the objective is sports.